is Phil Reese. I've spent much of my career meeting men and women called terrorists in the West. It used to be said that one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. But after 9/11, that seemed to change.
Either you are with us, or you are with the terrorists.
Western politicians list dozens of terrorist organizations. I'll be breaking bread with those labeled terrorists by the West and ask, when does a man have the right to fight without being called a terrorist? In the 1990s, the British government decided to talk with those it labeled terrorists. This led to the end of three decades of violence in Northern Ireland. Britain recognized that the Irish Republican Army had picked up the gun for a reason.
People do not use violence because they're addicted to it. People use violence out of desperation because they are voiceless. And that's why they use violence. They use violence to be heard.
But after 9/11, Western leaders announced that the world faced a dangerous new form of terrorism. While those who fought colonial power in the 20th century were called terrorists at the time, the new threat to the West is said to be very different.
The trouble with the Al-Qaeda form of terrorism, based on a complete perversion of the faith of Islam, is that it's unnegotiable.
Will history show this to be true? Or will the West one day be forced to negotiate with militant Islam?
Al-Jihad!
I'm travelling up the Falls Road. At one time, this was the centre of a nationalist rebellion against British rule in Northern Ireland. Armed rebels bearing the name of the Irish Republican Army have fought to reunite Ireland at various times after it was divided in 1923. Colonial rule ended in the mostly Catholic South and West, but Britain retained control of six counties where the majority was Protestant and wanted to remain in the Union. I'm in Belfast, the capital of Northern Ireland, to find out how Britain brokered a deal with men the government described as terrorists. In 1988, I went to the Milltown Cemetery to report on a funeral for three members of the IRA. They had been shot dead by Britain's special forces, the SAS, in Gibraltar. I'd arranged to meet Danny Morrison, a leading figure in the Irish nationalist movement. But things didn't turn out as planned. I brought Danny back to the cemetery, and we recalled an event that neither of us would easily forget. What are your memories of that day 20 years ago?
I didn't go up into the actual burial ground because there wasn't enough space. Basically, there was relatives, family, friends. So I stayed next to the cortege when the first explosion went off.
I ducked down, and certainly all the camera teams, we all ducked down, not knowing what was going on. But I saw you were just over there, about 20 metres away.
That's right. And we dived down underneath the actual, one of the hearses that had brought the remains to the cemetery. And when I jumped up, there was people screaming. There was a woman laying on the ground with blood pouring out of her. And then the shooting began. And a small number of people were focusing on this character who was wearing a holdall and who was pulling out hand grenades and throwing them. And that guy was a loyalist called Michael Stone.
Michael Stone was a fierce supporter of British rule in Northern Ireland. He killed three and injured 50.
One of the people who he shot dead was my friend Kevin Brady, best friend.
It was Kevin who drove me here.
That's right. And of course, at Kevin's funeral, two undercover British soldiers drove at high speed into his funeral cortege and caused panic and mayhem. And they were dragged out, and the IRA then came on the scene, and the IRA took them away and shot them.
So this amazing kind of cycle of violence was triggered by the three murders in Gibraltar.
Yes.
Danny justified murders committed by the IRA as part of war. Britain's portrayal of the group as terrorists, he told me, was deliberately used to prevent any discussion of the causes of the conflict.
The people who try to write the script and who try to circumscribe debate are the people who actually get into power through the use of state terrorism or historically through colonialism and imperialism. And you know, unless you examine that, you just cannot start the debate yesterday. You have to go back to the day before to discover the truth and what went on and why people are prepared to use violence or armed struggle against an authority.
The violence in Northern Ireland formally ended in 1998 after an agreement secured the rights of the minority Catholic community. Britain also accepted that it would leave Northern Ireland if, in the future, a majority wished it. The deal emerged only after the British government agreed to talk to those they once considered terrorists.
You make a judgment, one, about the leadership of the organisation. Are they actually serious about peace in the end? You know, they may have all sorts of tactical problems they've got within their own ranks. They may be engaged in a process where they've got to try and change the thinking of their people, but are they serious people? And there was something else as well that's very important in this. Both the British and the Irish Republicans had come to the conclusion that neither side could win by force.
Obviously, you've given up the armed struggle now, but you were involved in it for many, many years. I mean, the chief goal of yours was actually for a united Ireland. I mean, that hasn't been achieved. You are still a subject of the British Crown. Why did you lay down your guns then?
Well, first of all, this isn't the old Northern Ireland state that I grew up in or that my parents and my grandparents were humiliated in. By and large, people feel comfortable with the situation in that they feel that they're able to look forward to a united Ireland at some stage in the future. We're no longer being discriminated against. There's still some problems still have to be, and government still has to be tweaked. But the fact is, in a sense, the guerrillas fought and the guerrillas are in government.
History is full of examples of rebels who were labelled terrorists by their foes before becoming leaders of their nation. Amongst them, Nelson Mandela and Menachem Begin, the former Israeli leader. The right to challenge oppression was usually understood by those who weren't directly involved in the conflict. But after 9/11, Western leaders claimed something had changed.
The difficulty with this Al-Qaeda mass terrorism that resulted in September the 11th, it is terrorism in pursuit of an unnegotiable political demand. I mean, the IRA wanted a united Ireland. Well, it's not an unreasonable thing to want. You may agree with it, you may disagree with it, but it's not an unnegotiable demand. The trouble with the Al-Qaeda form of terrorism, based on a complete perversion of the faith of Islam, is that it's unnegotiable.
But, I mean, surely they argue the objectives are attainable, notably the removal of Western forces and influence from Islamic lands.
Yeah, no, I totally understand what their demand is, but, I mean, I think, you know, if we talk practical politics here, you know, the fact is to negotiate that all the countries in the Islamic world should not have any relationship with the West and of a military kind or whatever. I mean, it's not seriously negotiable, is it?
The West says it cannot negotiate because it is fighting religious fanatics, not people driven by rational grievances. Why do you think the United States is the target of so much of what you'd call terrorism?
I think they hate freedom, fundamentally, and I think we are the most free country, the freest country in the world, and I think that's what drives them.
You don't think it's related to injustice or, indeed, occupation of certain countries by the Americans?
I think the United States has been the greatest force for freedom, for justice, and for peace in the history of the world.
In Gaza, I joined a patrol by the military wing of Hamas before Israel's invasion. I found no one who believes the United States is a force for freedom, justice, or peace. Nor is it considered a nation that supports democracy. In 2006, politicians from Hamas won elections in the Palestinian territories. Despite this popular mandate, the outside world has refused to recognize its government because the movement is listed as a terrorist organization in the United States and Europe. And because of this, Israel believes it has the right to attack Gaza and depose an elected government. The United States supplies the weapons.
The US claims to espouse democracy, yet it allies itself in the Middle East with dictatorial regimes, and indeed, when there is democracy and Islamist parties win those elections, the US turns its back on the winners. It's fairly hypocritical, isn't it?
I think the whole question of the spread of democracy has been misunderstood. Every president of the United States, with the exception, I think, of John Quincy Adams, felt that the world would be made safer and more benign by the United States, which was engaged in, across the board, in the protection of human freedoms and human rights. So you talk about aligning ourselves with dictatorial, I forget what other rather prejudicial term you had, but...
Well, most of the Middle Eastern leaders who are loyal allies of the United States, so are not
Democrats.
Please
let me finish. The king of Saudi Arabia, King Abdullah, is as fine a man, I think, as anyone could ever imagine. He's trying to move a country ahead in a number of ways. President Mubarak in Egypt has done it somewhat.
President Mubarak arrested the man who was running against him for the presidency.
Well, it cleans up the election lines a bit, doesn't it? And, yeah, this is a regrettable thing. You saw the United States spoke out about it. These are not perfect lives, and nothing is perfect, and you just got to play the hand you get.
You can accept the principle that democracy is the best form of government, but not accept the outcome if terrorists prevail in it. But I think you're looking at this through a very narrow prism. The U.S. has interests that go beyond the form of government that a particular nation might choose.
So what are those interests? And do they explain why America is the target of Islamist violence?
George Bush asked the question, why do they hate us? He wasn't the first to ask that question. It was asked by Dwight Eisenhower when he was president. He asked his staff, why is there a campaign of hatred against us in the Arab world? The National Security Council said there's a perception in the Arab world that the United States supports brutal and tyrannical regimes and blocks democracy and development. And we do it because we want to control their oil resources. And it went on to say the perception is more or less accurate. And yes, this is the policy we should follow.
Next, I travel to Beirut and ask, is there a link between what the West calls Islamist terrorism and America's involvement in the Middle East? In order to find out more about the rise of Islamist movements in the Middle East, I've come to a city that for decades has been a refuge for those labeled terrorists in the West. The Palestine Liberation Organization was based here in the 1970s. After the killing of 11 Israeli athletes at the Munich Olympics, the PLO was seen by the West as the first international terrorist movement. But the PLO was not Islamist. Its roots were secular and socialist. In Lebanon today, Hezbollah, the Party of God, has taken on the mantle of the PLO as the major challenger to Israel and Western influence in the region. In Beirut's southern suburbs, Hezbollah is also the effective government, but it's listed as a terrorist organization in the United States. I've come to meet an old friend, Yunus Audi. In his youth, he was a fighter for the PLO. He's taking me to a restaurant with a curious menu. The meals celebrate weapons used by those labeled terrorists in the West. Yunus was well acquainted with the menu. As a PLO fighter, he'd received training in the Soviet Union in guerrilla warfare. What are you having on the menu? The terrorist meal?
No,
I am going for a cornet. It's designed for blowing up Israeli tanks.
I did. Oh, it comes under a helmet.
No, cornet.
This is a cornet. Oh, there's my RPG. Fantastic.
Yunus left the PLO when its leaders fled Lebanon after Israel's invasion in 1982. He believes that secular politicians in the Middle East have been corrupted by the West and failed their people.
People have been frustrated by their past experiences. The political model offered by Hezbollah, Hamas, and the Islamic Jihad movement has provided a successful example of how a liberation struggle can free land and people. Unlike other groups, they turn their slogans into reality.
Some Arabs followed communism, others secularism and Western ways. But in the end, they failed. They only brought weakness and destruction to their people. People are returning to Islam because Islam does not accept occupation and oppression.
Lebanon's role as a crucible of rebellion largely stems from its proximity to Israel. Tens of thousands of Palestinians sought refuge here when the Jewish state was formed in 1948.
I'm on my way to the largest Palestinian camp in Lebanon, Ain el-Helway. It's got more than 70,000 people stuffed into one square kilometer. It's also a cauldron for the much wider debate as to what methods should be used by people everywhere to oppose occupation.
If Palestinians threaten a violent challenge to Israel, they are labeled terrorists. Yet Israel's military dominance is bankrolled by the United States. The West's war on terror is asking the Palestinian nation to remain weak and bow to the superior military power of Israel and the United States. In this camp, support for the PLO has been falling. Yasser Arafat's fading images have become symbols of frustration and impotence.
There's an increasing feeling in this camp that their cause is not simply the struggle for Palestinian statehood. It's a wider conflict shared by Muslims elsewhere against those who are denying them the ability to control their future, the West.
Assalamu alaikum.
I've come to meet Palestinian fighters who say their enemy is not simply Israel, but also Western forces occupying other Muslim lands.
Almighty God has allowed the Palestinians to return to their faith. If they want to liberate their country, they will do it through Islam, not with the PLO.
These fighters believe Palestinians share a liberation struggle with the Taliban in Afghanistan. They are inspired by Osama bin Laden.
We truly ask the Almighty God that we serve at His feet. He is a mujahid who deserves to be our brother. That is the highest praise I can give.
Gandhi believes that all Muslims, including Palestinians, should follow the Taliban commander, Mullah Omar.
Mullah Omar.
From Afghanistan?
Yes, Mullah Omar. My love, Mullah Omar.
The West's response to 9/11 has allowed the idea to thrive in the Muslim world that the war on terror is a war on Islam. To understand how this has been used by Al-Qaeda to justify the deliberate murder of civilians, I arranged a rendezvous with a man who's wanted by several Western governments.
He was a close associate of the man responsible for the first World Trade Center attack, the Egyptian Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman.
One of his aliases is Abu Haytham. In his view, if the bodies of dead civilians are counted, then the West stands accused of the mass murder of Muslims.
If you just look at Iraq, even before the invasion, just during the embargo and the no-fly zone and all that, the whole world knew that about 1 million Iraqi children have died because of that. Since that time, the Americans have killed thousands more of Iraqis and thousands more of Muslims in Afghanistan and Pakistan and other places. Sheikh Osama bin Laden, may Allah preserve him, he said we need to kill 4 million before we're even. 4 million from the West before we're even.
If you look at who's responsible for more innocent civilian deaths, for example, if you put George Bush and Tony Blair on one hand and Osama bin Laden on the other, who do you think has caused the greatest number?
Certainly the greater number of deaths came in totality of the war. But I think you have to look at the political aim. Osama bin Laden was out to do as much damage as he could to Americans, American interests, and many other foreign interests, and continues unabated to this day to try to bring down Saudi Arabia, many other Middle Eastern governments, and the United States. The aims of Mr. Bush and Mr. Blair, I think, were very moral ones in their design. Now, in carrying them out, I would not argue with you.
That is true, and civilians die. Civilians die, innocent civilians die, when military action is taken. And that has always been the case in war. But I think for most ordinary people today, they find the notion of a terrorist act definable, the deliberate targeting of innocent civilians. They find it abhorrent, and they find this way of doing it new.
But there's nothing new about American servicemen fighting wars on foreign soil. During the last century, every generation of Americans has been at war. At the Arlington National Cemetery near Washington, rows of simple graves mark the sacrifice of those who have perished in distant wars. Many died with a genuine belief that America is making the world a better place. During the 20th century, the United States claimed an historic role to lead and export its values around the globe. The War on Terror was an attempt to ensure that America would remain the dominant world power in the 21st century. But it is faltering. The Muslim world is rejecting the global dominance of Western values and standing up to the might of the United States.
There's a consequence to things that you do. People don't just collapse and say, thank you, please cut my throat. You know, so yes, you get reactions.
People fight back.
So often they fight back. And in the case of, say, 9/11, which was a major terrorist act, of course, no serious analyst has any doubt about the fact that it's a consequence of U.S. policies in the Middle East.
The decision of a government to refuse to negotiate with those listed as terrorists is usually based on simple self-interest.
The reason why they do not want to talk, it's because they know what the answer is. The answer is that they have to give something. The reason why they're occupying certain places, it could be for oil, it could be for territory, it could be increasingly for water, whatever. That's why people do not want to debate. It's the people in power who do not want to debate, not the people who are oppressed.
Before the War on Terror can have its armistice day, the West will need to negotiate with people it now considers terrorists. And it must recognize that where there is injustice, the right to resist power is as legitimate now as it has ever been.